Hello and welcome to this episode of The Richards Report. I'm speaking with former Minister of Finance for the Australian Government and current Essendon Football Club Chairman, Lindsay Tanner. We speak about football, politics and the similarities between the two. I think it's a real insight to learn from Lindsay from his decades of experience in the public and private sectors. Okay, a bit of admin before we begin. All information discussed in this podcast is for educational purposes only. As I don't know your individual circumstances, this does not qualify as investment advice. If you haven't already, can you please go onto iTunes and give me a rating? Preferably a 5-star rating. It helps other people find the Richards Report, and I'd really appreciate it. Thanks, Mum. I know you have. If you're on Facebook, don't forget to like the Richards Report page there too. And don't be shy on the likes there. They do wonders for my ego. Okay, enough of the admin. Let's get straight into it. This episode, I'm speaking with Lindsay Tanner.
You're listening to The Richards Report, where we will speak with investment experts from around the country. We will cut through the jargon to allow you to make more insightful investment decisions for your future. This is The Richards Report.
Hi, Lindsay. Thanks for chatting with me on The Richards Report, episode number 10. I don't want to get ahead of myself with this episode, but I'm predicting this to be at least in the top 10 best episodes I've ever done. Welcome, Lindsay.
Thanks very much, Ted.
Lindsay, so much has occurred in your life that if we started with you growing up in Orbost, Victoria, we'd have to make this a 5-part series, as you really have had an incredible life so far. So apologies for skimming over the earlier periods of your life. And I should also apologise to all my listeners in Orbost for skimming over your chapter 2. So let's fast forward a bit and surprise, surprise, let's go straight into football, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
You're currently chairman of the Essendon Bombers in the AFL. How is it being chairman of a professional football club? From my own experience, I can see how much time Sydney Swans chairman and big Richards Report fan Andrew Pridham is required to be at the club for meetings, games and interstate travel, and not to mention all the speeches that you're required to make too. How are you finding it?
Oh, it's not too bad. It is reasonably time consuming, and it would probably be more time consuming for Andrew because there are certain things that happen in Melbourne like the Brownlow and meetings with the AFL and so forth. But it is reasonably time consuming. A day at the football really is a day these days because you've got to be there for the pre-game function, all that stuff, be in the rooms after the game. And there's always coterie events and other things. So we had, for example, in the last week or so, we've had a barbecue out at Tullamarine for the various coteries. And about 6 days before that, we had a launch of a coffee table book for donors who'd helped finance the construction of that fantastic new facility. So there's always stuff going on. So what it does require, I think, to be in the position is that you've got to be able to juggle those commitments with other things. So it's not really that compatible with having a full-time ordinary job. But if, like me, you've got a number of part-time commitments, then you can make it work.
Interesting. And before we move on to the next topic, here's a question without notice. As chairman of the Essendon Bombers, how many games would someone need to play for Essendon to be considered for the Essendon Hall of Fame? Would 33 games be adequate?
I'm not sure who this hypothetical player with 33 games might conceivably be, but although I can't, off the top of my head, remember the number, I think it might be 200 or something. I think 33 probably doesn't cut it because the Hall of Fame would be rather crowded.
fair enough. Okay. Moving from football into finance, you were Minister for Finance, and then in 2007 and 2008, the global financial crisis hits. I've had the odd bad day at fullback when I'm under attack from all angles, but at least the siren goes off every now and then, and you can give yourself a bit of oxygen, and at least a spray from John Longmire can only go for so long. How did you find such a relentless, high-pressure role at such a unique time in history?
It was very stressful at times, and we had periods when we had meetings in the cabinet room, which has got no windows and is a pretty claustrophobic, relatively small room, where we would be meeting from 8 o'clock in the morning through all day and pretty much well into the night as well, with different meetings, different groups of people, all about the budget, the state of the banking system, all of the issues that were very much in play. So it was pretty stressful. I can remember at the time the National Secretary of the Labor Party, and I bumped into him at a meeting, said to me, "Oh, mate, I hope you're keeping a diary of all this. This is all very historic." And I just looked at him and laughed and said, "Who in the hell's got time to keep a diary?"
Reality is you would have been having discussions about the country's budget and being able to pay the country's bills.
Well, and the biggest problem was the connection between Australia and the rest of the world, because we were actually in pretty reasonable shape, but we were quite dependent. We still are fairly dependent on the global financial system for financing our banking system. So the money that is lent to people buying homes through mortgages, only roughly about 60-65% of that actually comes from the bank deposits of Australians. The rest is coming from foreign investors through loans to our banks that they in turn then lend to people buying houses. And that all has worked pretty reasonably well over the years. But of course, what happened in the peak of the GFC was that sort of half shut down. And the price that we had to pay to continue to borrow, that money just went through the roof. And that had a knock-on effect in a whole lot of ways. But the associated challenge was businesses and consumers freaking out. Because if you're worried about, you know, hey, am I going to lose my job next week? Then you stop spending money. And if you're a business worried about the risk of going out of business, then maybe you don't put on the extra five people you might have been thinking of employing, or that new investment into something different, you might close that down. And of course, everybody starts acting like that, everything shrinks. So it was a very, very challenging time for Australia. But the real source of it all was, of course, the external forces, particularly American forces. And I can barely imagine what it would have been like being at the heart of that, trying to manage the US economy and financial system.
Yeah, and I guess there's no game plan that you can look back on to see how it worked in the past. You were probably having to come up with initiatives and plans as to what you think would work going forward.
Well, that's right. There are lots of lessons from the past, but it's never exactly the same. And so you can get some ideas and some indications of what's going on and what's the appropriate way of dealing with them by looking at the lessons of history. But it's always a mistake to imitate them. You know, so you've got to be very careful about forming your judgments. We were very cognizant of the fact that we were a first-term government after there being a long period of Conservative government, and that just around the time we were taking office was when the global financial crisis was really starting to take hold. And there was a very stark historical parallel with the Great Depression in the early 1930s, where a Labor government got elected after having been out of office for 13 years. Very similar issues that led to the change of government. And literally as they were taking office, the Great Depression and the Wall Street crash are starting. So one of the things that a lot of us had in our minds was that, you know, the sense of history may be repeating itself. Now, obviously, there are a lot of differences as well. But you do inevitably pay attention to the lessons of history, but you've also got to deal with what's in front of you. So there were things, new things, new stuff, lots of these complicated financial instruments, like credit default swaps and stuff like that didn't exist in the Great Depression, obviously.
Yeah, I think the quote is from Mark Twain, "History doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes."
Yes, exactly.
I read a quote that you said about politics, and that is, politics is a bit like malaria. Once you've got it, you never get rid of it. And I think that encapsulates people like myself who enjoy playing at fullback too. I think I may have got fullback malaria one day. Probably caught it in Canberra too in a NAB Cup game. My question is this. When and where did you catch this political malaria?
Well, the quote actually was stolen from my former colleague, Michael Lee, and I don't know, he might have nicked it off somebody else, but yep. I've used it many times. Probably in my mid-teens, and it had there was a combination of factors. One was I was in a country boarding school at a place called Gippsland Grammar School, where I got a fantastic education, a very high-quality school, but the boarding house was horrible. And so I was instinctively rebellious and unhappy about how that all worked. And it was also a period of time where the Conservatives had been in power for over 20 years, and there was just the emergence of a groundswell for social and economic change that was manifesting itself in a whole lot of different ways that ultimately led to the Whitlam government being elected in 1972. So I was 16 when the Whitlam government got elected, and I can remember watching it on the TV and cheering and being really pleased about it. So I come from a National Party family. My parents were both National Party members, and my mother worked in the office of a federal National Party minister and quite an iconic senior National Party figure for 7 or 8 years, Peter Nixon. So there's always been a certain amount of eyebrow raising at my political activities. They're a bit outside where they perhaps might have liked them to be.
Well, most 16-year-olds I know, they cheer when the latest Xbox or PlayStation comes out. So I'm sure that you were ahead of your time there.
To be fair to the current generation of 16-year-olds, it was a very different era. And if you look across sort of modern history, you'll see that politics goes up and down in terms of being interesting and exciting and fashionable. So there are periods of time when it's the place to be and lots of young people are active and doing stuff, and then there's other periods of time when it's not. So I was just lucky to, you know, come to adulthood at a time when politics was about the most exciting it's been for the last 50 years. So we had Richard Nixon and Watergate. You know, the Whitlam government was like just amazing, both in terms of what it was doing, but also all the mad stuff that went on. So it just happened that I came into that age when you start to get interested in these things at a time when it was about as exciting and interesting as it's been for decades.
In our discussions at Six Park, I remember that you once said about politics, everyone exaggerates everything all of the time. Side note, I think this applies to a former teammate of mine, Dan Hannabury, too, despite him not being a politician. Anyway, so why do politicians exaggerate so much?
It's necessary to get attention first, so that if you express yourself in a moderate, considered, cautious way, then people switch off or you don't get your message across. So it's, you might as well ask, why do advertisers exaggerate as well? You know, why do you get the sort of kabam, kapow, flashing light sort of stuff? It's to grab people's attention. And secondly, the way that public debate works and the interaction with the ordinary person, they're not sitting there listening intently to what you're saying and thinking carefully about it and weighing it up against what the other person's saying. If you're lucky, you might get a few seconds of distracted time. So you can't afford to complicate things. You can't afford to concede that there are weaknesses in your position. And so the end result is that exaggeration is normal, because to do anything else is deadly. You know, that if you don't exaggerate, you're dead.
Okay, yeah.
And so it's, you know, it's kind of like, a similar question is, you know, why do footballers go full tilt chasing the ball? The answer is, if you don't, you're not going to get it.
Yes, yep. And I think in football it can be an industry where you need to exaggerate, because unless you're the best team in the competition, you're nowhere.
Yeah, well, that's right. And that's a very good point. It's intensely competitive, and so you've got to be like that. And there's a natural dimension of people being very driven. And so that tends to mean you have very strong belief in your own arguments or your own position, which will therefore make you exaggerate. But it's important to note that in spite of popular prejudice, politicians rarely lie. They mislead all the time.
Oh, okay.
They rarely outright lie. So a lie is when you make a statement that you know is false. Now, it's not very often that politicians actually do that, but it's very common for them to make a statement that, when you read the fine print, is technically true, but they are creating a different impression for somebody who's not paying much attention. So John Howard was a master at this. You know, he didn't lie most of the time.
Yep.
But he was very good at using words to convey a more favourable impression of something than was warranted. And so the end result is, for people, once they work it out, they think he's lying, but technically he's not. It's a magician trick. It's the, you know, three-card trick kind of thing. Politicians do that all the time.
this somewhat flows onto my next topic. So we've touched on football and touched on politics. Now I'm interested to know, what are the similarities between the two?
Oh, we've already mentioned one, which is how intensely competitive it is. Another one, which is always interesting, is that the real competition in politics is with people on your own side. So, yes, you come together as a team to compete against the other side, but the real competition for personal advancement and your career is with the people closest to you. And there's an element of that in football. So, you know, the real competition...
Most pre-seasons are like that.
Yeah, well, exactly. Well, you know, if you've got two good quality ruckmen at your club these days, one of them's going to struggle to get a game. So who's your competition? Well, yes, it's the other teams you're playing against, but your real competition is the other ruckman that you're trying to get in the spot. You know, there's only going to be one guy as the key fullback. So, you know, if at least there's more options there for you. If you end up losing your spot at fullback, you know, you've got a reasonable chance of playing somewhere else. But it's similar in politics, is that it's intensely individually competitive, but you're also competing as a team.
They're the similarities. What are the main differences between football and politics?
Oh,
I know there'd be many.
Yeah, probably people more interested in football to start with. You can sort of stay in politics a bit older than your early 30s.
From an outsider's point of view, it seems like there's a few more leaks in politics.
Oh, yeah. It's this is the interesting thing. It's something I'm very proud of at Essendon, that in the time I've been on the board, which is about 3 years now, in fact, it's almost exactly 3 years, there's not been a single leak from our board, in spite of the fact that most of the time we've been very high-profile media for all the wrong reasons. Whereas in the political world, leaking is kind of near universal and seen as normal, and everybody assumes that, and everybody puts on a confected outrage and throws tantrums when it happens, when they don't like it. But of course, next week they'll be doing it. So it is pretty quite different. But a lot of leaking is not sinister. It's accidental, because journalists are very clever at putting together bits of a jigsaw. So a journalist might talk to you and just a general chat, and you're being very careful not to tell them that your club might be interested in recruiting Dustin Martin or something, but you might let slip some little bit of information that by itself looks completely innocuous. But they get three or four of those little bits of information from three or four different people, suddenly they've got a good picture and a valid story. So a lot of leaks are a bit like that. It's not somebody deliberately creating trouble. It's just a clever journalist being able to get little bits out of people.
So I touched on football, touched on politics. I've also seen that you've written a book called Comfort Zone. And surprise, it's actually a fiction book, available from Booktopia for $20. And I also believe there's an up-and-coming bookshop called Amazon that's probably sells it too. And I thought I'd give Amazon a shout-out as I try and like to help the up-and-comers.
Sure, they'll appreciate it.
Anyway, no doubt Woosher and the boys at Essendon would be all over Comfort Zone. Well, what's been the response from the likes of Joey Danaher?
I doubt whether they are even aware that I've published a novel. None of them mention it. In fact, I'd be a bit nervous about talking to them about it. But it's something I'd always sort of had in the back of my mind as wanting to give a try, because I've published about seven or eight non-fiction books over the years, which are all, you know, serious political kind of things, which is not that hard if, you know, it's a bit like an extension of your day job. And I've never thought of myself as a particularly creative or imaginative sort of person. So I always wanted to put myself to the test and see, you know, what's this like? Can I do it? And it was tough. And it's what you do learn is that it's like any other craft. There's a whole lot of serious skills and specialisation there that, you know, even as a reader, as a consumer, you're not aware of. In the same way that the ordinary fan would not be aware of some of the fine detail skill stuff that goes on in football, you know, because that's complex. And, you know, a guy like yourself, you know, you'd be trained to do certain things in certain circumstances and whatever. Well, it's the same writing a novel, you know. So I've read countless novels, but none of that prepared me for the challenge of actually writing one and learning by making mistakes and having expert people like my publisher explain to me why this bit was crap and why I shouldn't do this and whatever. And it all made sense, but it's a craft like any other.
This is a question that I asked most of my guests, but on the topic of books, have you got a favourite book, be it fiction or non-fiction, that you recommend to listeners?
I read a huge amount. I still consider the best book I've ever read, which tells you something about me as a person, unfortunately, is War and Peace by Tolstoy, but it's 1,300 pages, so I'm not necessarily recommending people go out and read it, but it is an incredible, absolutely incredible book. I'll give one little plug, though, for a recent trio of books that I've read. I'm a big fan of crime fiction. There's this whole genre of crime fiction with the kind of troubled detective that's emerged across a whole lot of different countries in the past 20 years. A lot of Scandinavian ones, but there's Egyptian, Italian, all kinds, and they're all really good. But there's this newish writer who called Luke McCallan, who's English from memory, who lived and worked in Bosnia for the United Nations for about 6 years post the war in Yugoslavia. And he's written three novels about a German police detective, captain, who's sort of anti-Nazi, but who's functioning as a normal detective in the middle of the Second World War with the Nazi regime as a German. So it's Luke McCallan, and from memory they're called The Ashes of the Man from Berlin. I can't remember the second name of the second one. The third one's The Ashes of Berlin. They're absolutely fantastic, really, really good. They convey the sense of drama, horror and madness that was Nazi Germany and stuff, but there's also a crime mystery woven through it. So they're the most recent ones.
I'll have those books up on the show notes.
They're brilliant, absolutely brilliant. But look, I could prattle on about books for hours and not stop because there's so many worthwhile good things out there to read. And
you should sign up for Joey Danaher's book club.
I don't know why you're picking on Joe.
Now you're out of politics, you've got many roles in the corporate world. Let's discuss just a couple. Lazard Australia. Corporate advisory work on mergers, acquisitions and privatisations. Can you tell us a bit about that role?
Well, I'm not an investment banker, obviously, but the primary role that Lazard plays, it's a purely advisory firm, so it does compete against the big investment banks like Macquarie and UBS and Goldman Sachs who do advisory work, but they also are handling money, they're underwriting debt, they're trading, doing all kinds of other things. Lazard is one of the so-called independents, so it advises only, the idea being that there are no conflicts, it's more trustworthy for prospective clients. And a lot of the deals that the firm gets involved with involve political or regulatory issues, the ACCC, Foreign Investment Review Board, all kinds of things, where having somebody on the team who understands how all those things work and can read between the lines and understand who's doing what. I call it reading the play, because anybody can look up the rules, but it's a very different thing to be able to predict exactly what's likely to happen with a given transaction. Also, obviously, I've got a lot of connections and relationships with serious corporate decision makers who are prospective clients, so there's a business development element. I'm a bit involved in corporate entertainment. My usual first week back at work in January is to take people to the tennis, which is a pretty arduous task. But that's broadly it. So, and every day is different, and it's just really helping, you know, being somebody who helps the team out to, you know, win mandates, tackle problems. And we do quite a lot of work for government. So we were the advisors on the sale of Medibank Private, for example. You might I've noticed the recent sale of the New South Wales and Victorian shares in the Snowy Hydro scheme to the Commonwealth. Well, we were advising the Commonwealth there. So we, obviously, somebody like me who used to be finance minister, you know, so I was the part owner of the Snowy Hydro scheme as finance minister, means I've got a lot of miscellaneous knowledge about how this stuff works in government and how people think and what they're on about.
Another of your roles is you're now currently a non-executive director and member of the risk committee with Suncorp. being a publicly listed company, I'm not going to ask you about what you're discussing right now. However, can you shed some light for us as to the mandate of the Risk Committee?
The two main committees that a large listed company will have, they usually have several, but the two main ones are audit and risk. And risk is really about strategy, about working through what the future looks like and what are the potentially unexpected things that might blow you off course, and essentially putting the pressure on management to make sure that they are conscious of all the possible things that could go wrong and have got a sophisticated assessment of how likely they are and what happens if they do go wrong and what we then do if that happens. So classic sort of thing is, because we're both a bank and an insurance company, if you get some sort of major economic meltdown overseas that has a knock-on effect, then we've got to work through that. Huge weather events. So one of the things we track very closely, of course, is extreme weather events, because one extreme weather event just bang, $60 or $70 million gone from our bottom line.
Through the insurance division?
Through the insurance thing, but it can have an impact also on the banking side, because if it means that people suddenly are no longer able to cover their mortgage loans and so on, that flows through there.
And I feel that's relevant because Suncorp is so exposed to the Queensland market, and that we have seen the extreme weather events in Queensland.
We have a thing called a natural hazard allowance, which is basically a budget item for the year that says we are assuming that there will be X million dollars worth of insurance claims off the back of extreme weather events, etc., etc. And that's very, very difficult to estimate, of course. So there's a whole lot of those really obvious risks, but there's different kind of risks, like all major companies are grappling with cyber risk and, the risk of data breaches and stuff like that. So the Risk Committee's job is just to be relentlessly working through and ramming home to management those things and acting as the more detailed board process for assessing and dealing with those things and ensuring that they're being handled correctly.
You're also a director with Virgin Australia. My question to you is this. My wife, the kids and I are having a family holiday to Fiji, and you as a board member have autonomy to hand out upgrades. I want to qualify this by saying that I'm sure my wife will fully understand if you can only upgrade one passenger, as I know she'll have a lot of fun with the kids back in economy. So any chance?
Well, unfortunately, it's hard enough getting upgrades for ourselves, let alone anybody else, for perfectly legitimate reasons. No, I think we're very fortunate in Australia that we actually have two high-quality airlines serving, both the domestic market but also a number of international markets as well. And, of course, the range of choice on the international front's now huge. But when you do fly some places overseas, you realise just how good the overall standard of service is in Australia. And people lose sight of the fact that running an airline's unbelievably complicated, and they're all networked so tightly in order to maximise the convenience and efficiency that something goes wrong somewhere, which is going to happen every now and then, it throws everything out fairly quickly. So you get one computer glitch that's not the airline's fault, it's whoever's the global software supplier that shuts everything down for 4 hours even just in one spot, that ripples through everything. So there's a very delicate balance to be maintained between maximising the convenience and efficiency of the whole show, but at the same time minimising the effect of when something goes wrong. So, you would have no doubt experienced when you get crosswinds at Sydney Airport, which is about three quarters of the time from yep. what it feels yep. like, down to one runway, and that, of course, ripples through. That affects somebody flying from Adelaide to Perth because the planes are flying all around Australia all the time.
You're also on the Investment Advisory Committee of Six Park, and full disclosure, they are the sponsor of this podcast, and I'm also involved with Six Park too. However, what I want to know is this. If big Australian banks like Suncorp and Lazard and international airlines like Virgin, all of which are huge publicly listed companies, want you on their board, why did you decide to join Six Park?
I'm mainly interested in learning. So in a sense, the answer is implicit in your question, which is that I've had a lot of exposure since I got out of Parliament to the big end of town and to large companies and the issues that face big organisations. And in many respects, that's a natural terrain for me. But I'd never been involved in a startup. I didn't have any great experience of fintech companies, stuff like that. So I was attracted to by the idea of learning about stuff that I didn't really know or understand. And it's been a great ride. I've really enjoyed it, and I think it's a great venture. And it's one of those happy marriages where it's a commercial venture, but it's also producing social good, because the basic differentiation from the traditional mainstream financial services market is cutting the fees that people pay. And the sad thing is about fees in the financial services world is that because they are recurring and that they are on products that are long-term investment products, what seems like a trivial difference between 2% and 1% over 10 or 20 years is a big difference, because that money is compounding over that time. So Six Park and various other ventures are doing great stuff by putting downward pressure on fees, because that means that huge numbers of ordinary working people out there will have access to effectively a cheaper, just as good quality service, and end up with more money for their retirement, and significantly more money, and therefore a better standard of living. So that also attracts me, that there is a positive social purpose in all of this.
I enjoy sitting in on the Six Park Investment Advisory Committee meetings, as it's incredible that the detail that the committee go into. I think a fellow member of the committee, Paul Costello, calls it pothole spotting. Right now, how do you try and spot potholes for Six Park clients when Donald Trump is over the other side of the world doing things that no one can predict?
He has made life somewhat more difficult. In fact, I did coin the phrase that, underlining the point that you always needed some human dimension, even though we've got a highly automated system, and that's the whole logic of getting the cost down, is that you can't produce an algorithm for Donald Trump. So you do need an element of human oversight and sort of second opinion, just to keep an eye on some of the things that are impossible to measure and predict. So one of the things when Trump got elected is we had to form views about to what extent is there a risk of a trade war, what happens if he actually builds a wall on the Mexican border, even risks with potential nuclear conflict. There's all kinds of things that come into play, and that's why it's a good idea to have a small degree of human overlay over the algorithms that are actually calculating, you know, how to distribute the investments according to your individual profile. And it's interesting, because it does force you to think about the world. This is one of the big transformations that's occurred in the process of saving an investment in Australia over the past 20-odd years, which is that most Australian savings 20, 30 years ago would have been invested in Australia. In fact, the vast bulk of it would have been invested in Australia. In the globalised world, one of the things that people don't recognise is that just as we've got, you know, Chinese, American, Japanese investment going on in Australia, there's a huge amount of Australian investment in those countries and other countries as well. And so increasingly, people saving for their retirement in Australia are investing in other countries. And it makes sense, because that diversifies your risk, and it gives you the potential to go for higher return options, but also safer options. So it's actually very important to do. And one of the key things that's great about the Six Park product is that it enables you to diversify over those sort of rest of the world things without the unbelievable hassle and fluffing around that is involved with doing it directly. So by being involved with a Six Park product, you get access to the German property market or Brazilian government bonds or whatever. They're all in the mix according to your risk profile. But if you ever are silly enough to want to go out and try and buy Brazilian government bonds yourself or invest in German property, well, not silly, but persistent. Yeah. There's a lot of buggerizing around, basically. So it provides a very simple way for people to have a diverse sort of base investment that spreads across pretty well everything in varying degrees. And that's very, very hard to do as an ordinary individual with a modest amount of superannuation savings.
As mentioned earlier, this episode has been brought to you by Six Park, the leading robo-advisor in Australia. Go to sixpark.com.au and take the free risk assessment and see how Six Park would invest your funds. All of Six Park's investments are overseen by the Six Park Investment Advisory Committee, which includes Lindsay. On a $10,000 investment, total annual fees are just 0.5%, which is just $50 a year. If you'd like to find out more, check out sixpark.com.au. Lindsay, thank you very much for your time. Good luck to Essendon in the upcoming season. And most of all, thank you in advance for the upgrade. Please make sure on my passport it says Edward, not Ted.
Thanks very much, Sid.
Thank you.
Well done.
Wait a second before I go. Don't forget to give the Richards Report a rating on iTunes and a follow on Facebook. See you next time on the Richards Report.